Welcome to this Friday edition of the WHFR Journal. Today is the 8th of November, and what a week it's been. We are looking forward to talking about some things that are forthcoming here on our campus community, and so very excited to take the direction of theater once again here at HFC. Susan McGraw with you. Thanks for joining us on WHFR.FM. Joining me in studio at this time is HFC Director of Theater, Dr. John Michael Seffel, who is directing the upcoming performance that I know will be absolutely brilliant called Dear Harvey, taking place starting a week from today, actually, through the following Saturday. And Dear Harvey chronicles the life of Harvey Milk, civil rights activist, politician, LGBTQ plus icon, who was assassinated, sadly, in November of 1978. And we know the story, perhaps, from the very famous movie called Milk. We maybe have heard different iterations of this particular story, but this one is going to be truly, truly special. Dr. John Michael is joined in studio today with Chelsea Lonsdale, who is serving as consultant and faculty dramaturg for this particular performance, this particular presentation. And I'm wondering, we'll find out if Chelsea has done this before. And I'm hopeful that she might say yes, but if not, we'll be very excited to get her take on this first time around. So welcome to both of you. So happy to have you here today.
Thank you. Thank Wonderful you. To be back.
So much going on around this particular production. John Michael, tell us a little bit about how this whole thing came to be, and then we'll incorporate all the sort of the side aspects of benefits of having this on our campus.
Yeah, absolutely. One of really the chief missions of our theater program here is to make sure that we are trying to capture and represent the voices of our community, primarily the HFC campus community, but also beyond, which is why I hope some of your listeners will remember the Detroit Wall Project last year, where we took a somewhat unflinching look at housing policies in the region. And then with our productions like Tenderly, Leo's Big Day Out, and some big plans for next year, really trying to make sure that we are centering the voices of Dearborn's Arab American population. With this particular show, we're really looking at really important themes and identity of the LGBTQ plus community here on campus and their allies and just anyone who cares about and loves civil rights, and really talking about how the history of stepping up for and being there for any marginalized people. That's not something that we invented today or yesterday or any time in recent memory. And so taking a moment to look back at Harvey Milk, and importantly, his community and the people that stood with him back in the 70s, back when I was just recently born, and looking at the ways that some of these themes have changed so very much. Some of them don't seem to have changed at all. And really hammering home to particularly the students involved that there's a history of making change and that anybody can stand up, anybody can do it. And if Harvey could and if Harvey's friends could, then so can they.
Those are important life lessons that maybe we all need to hear, especially right now. When we try to introduce topics that are very serious and very profound to a student community, what I've found is that they tend to be very receptive to this and willing to put themselves out there and just, you know, just give it a go. It's the greater community at large that sometimes tends to be like, whoa, what are you doing that for at the HFC? Why don't we have, Grease playing at our theater this time around, you know? Why this?
And it's a great question, and I adore sort of the mid-20th century classic musicals and things like that. One of the big reasons is that we are not a commercial theater. We are here as an educational theater, and so we tend to do pieces that they may not have done elsewhere. We're not picking the plays by the popularity of the titles or anything like that. Entertainment, you know, it was the Roman poet Horace that talked about the purpose of theater is twofold. It is to sort of entertain and please, but it's also to teach. And so, yes, there are plenty of theaters out there that are leaning more into the entertainment. We certainly care about that, too. We want you to come and have a great time and be moved and all those things. But as an educational theater, as a college campus, I think it's absolutely our responsibility to make sure that we're bringing the teach and that we are making sure that students recognize theater is not merely a, oh, we can try to copy what they did on Broadway, but we can find a way to express our voice, our thoughts. One of the reasons that we do so many original shows here is because it is a chance to say, in this age of anxiety and age of students not knowing necessarily always how to go out and meet people and do those things, hey, get up there, use your own voice, say something, and learn to sort of exist in your skin in this world.
We're so looking forward to this presentation, this production. Chelsea, may I ask, you're involved in this in, I think, a pretty important way, although you're not necessarily going to be in that black box theater performing.
Right.
They are an extension of what you've been sharing with, and I know we'll continue to share as we get ready for this to start next week, as a consultant and mm-hmm. also someone that's passionate about this subject matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. how's this been for you?
Yeah, so this is a new experience for me. I did theater in high school, small acting roles. So I've never been involved with theater in this way, and I wasn't totally sure what my role was, but you captured it. It's that passion. Dr. John had said that that he will direct and I can be the heart of the play. It's my job to care about the play, and I very much do. And so my role has been, I've been present at most rehearsals, kind of helping to facilitate conversation with the cast around the lines that they're learning and the people that they're playing and the voices that they're sharing, and helping to make connections between their lived experiences and the lived experiences of the characters and the actual people in the show. And those have been some really, really rewarding, really beautiful conversations.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Some things are maybe called something different today, but it's kind of the same, you know, things just sort of keep circling back again and again. So while this is sort of a period piece, if you will, mm-hmm. it's certainly ever present and ever important today and probably forever. Mm-hmm. So have you had connections with students sort of talking about maybe personal experiences, or how deep do you get in that sort of analysis of the material to then help them relate to it and sort of keep that heart beating?
Yeah, we have sometimes. So sometimes during rehearsal, we might stop and say, you know, what are those words that you're saying? Like, what do those words mean to you when you hear the word bathhouse, or when you see the word homophobia? Like, what does that mean to you? Where do you feel that in your body? What do you know about that? What background knowledge do you have? And I see myself pulling on my background a little bit as a reading and writing teacher, you know, as I'm sort of walking through, like, these are words that you are speaking. What do they mean to you? What do you bring to them? So sometimes, yeah, sometimes we've had conversations amongst the cast that have been pretty intimate.
One of the fun things about my job is how much I get to learn. So I'm coming in here and I'm doing these shows, and it is my job to be an expert in how do we figure out how to light this and where does this person stand and all those things. But that's often where my expertise ends. And so in having these conversations about any given play, including plays that deal with identity so much, as Dear Harvey does, as the Detroit Wall Project did, etc., I do my best to decenter myself as much as I can, which is very difficult in that setting, to be the director but not want to be the loudest voice in the room. And so I love when we're able to bring in voices, especially voices that the cast trusts as much as Dr. Lonsdale. This idea of, anyone who's on campus knows how beloved Dr. Lonsdale is to students and respect and all that, and being able to have those conversations in that space that I can then go, yep, that sounds great, now go stand over there. That allows me to do my job and allows us to really dig into materials. So.
Yeah. Without giving too much away, and we are talking about the production that is forthcoming called Dear Harvey. It starts Friday the 15th, a week from today, through Saturday, November 23rd. And while we have, some of us at least, the gist of who this title character is, we don't necessarily know from what perspective the story will be told, etc. How deep does this get, and you know, where we go with it?
Absolutely. Great question. Thank you for asking. This is not a traditional narrative. So if anyone has gone and seen the Milk movie or something like that, it's not like that at all. This is what you would call a docudrama, which if anyone saw Detroit Wall Project last year, that was another docudrama. So we have this fascinating opportunity where all of the actors are somewhat playing characters, but they're also always playing themselves in a way. They're standing there as themselves, then sort of taking on and quoting various characters. And as this happens, it was the play itself was pulled together by Patricia Lowy, based on a series of interviews and archives and things from people who had known Harvey, worked with Harvey, dear friends of Harvey's, etc. And so these stories and these memories of Harvey Milk and those fighting alongside him, clips from his speeches, things like that. So we have this ability to sort of step into and understand not only, sure, what happened in 1978, but what it means to look at the world, to say we need to have hope, even in difficult situations, to say how can we spread that hope and move forward, and to hopefully inspire the audience to see how he looked around him. It wasn't just, you know, yes, he was absolutely a member of the gay community and absolutely talked about rights, but that was by far not the only thing he did. I mean, he was fighting for public transport. He was fighting for immigration rights. He was hugely influential around pushing for the rights of the elderly. He talked about how he saw the government treating senior citizens as, he said, old beer cans and kind of crushing them up and throwing them away. And he said, we can't do that. We need to cherish all people. And so having this opportunity to just try to get into that mindset over the hour and 15 minutes that the play is and say, look at how any person can stand up and make a change for their community, whatever that community may be. Mm-hmm. That's really why we wanted to do this play.
Yeah, it really speaks to that mindset that, you know, one person isn't one thing, right? Or representing one way of living, etc., that we are multifaceted people. We are, if dare I say, a quilt that could be, you know, sewn together beautifully to showcase the multiple stories and so on. And if John Michael's eyes just rolled, it's because of the bad segue that I just did. But we have to talk about the AIDS quilt. This is such an exciting aspect of what's happening. And it actually kicks off today, as I understand, here this Friday. So a panel from the AIDS quilt will actually be on display here at HFC for the duration of this play, this performance. This is just brilliant. World AIDS Day is December 1st, and so it will be here for that. And we have to, again, understand that this is not the whole quilt. I understand that is quite a large, multi-ton, you know, beautiful yes. piece of art. But to have a panel from the AIDS quilt, I mean, that's just about the coolest thing, you know, that I can think of as it relates to this concept and the storyline. How did this come together?
So first, I think it's really important, and thank you for bringing this up. Yeah, there are at this point almost 50,000 panels, and wow. Each one of these panels are approximately 12 feet. So these are very, very Jeez. Large pieces. To back up for a little bit here, what the AIDS quilt is back in the 80s, an activist named Cleve Jones, who was very, very dear friends with Harvey Milk, watched as the AIDS crisis was not only killing so many people, but also the stigma around the AIDS crisis was erasing people. There were so many people who were effectively disappearing as people either claimed they were dying of cancer rather than saying sort of the word, or just not talking about it at all. And he came up with the idea of, we really need some sort of a community project. We need to remember. And so began a project where anyone, you know, in the world could send in sewn or drawn on or whatever panels for this large quilt. I'm sure never expecting it to become the project that it is today, with, again, over 50,000. I'm sorry, with over 50,000 panels, yeah, and more than 110,000 individuals named on it. So over the years, that's happening, and it has covered the entire National Mall at times. It is a major, major national memorial project and the largest community arts project in the world. And it just so happens that a large part of our play features an actor playing Cleve Jones and talking about that moment when he came up with the idea and talking about the importance of it. And as we were sitting there in the rehearsal, we want to talk about the importance of having Dr. Chelsea Lonsdale there. Dr. Chelsea Lonsdale mentioned, like, oh, yeah, the quilt, that can be brought in.
Wow.
And so phone calls were made and quick forms were signed, and we were able to get that in here. And I'm very, very proud that not only do we have a panel, but we were specifically able to get the Detroit chapter of the NAMES Project panel here.
Wow.
So the names of the people represented, that people can come in and see, they are all people who are connected to this area. So just to really remind our students and everyone attending, this is not a story of 1978 California. This is a story of our own neighborhood, our own community, back then and every day since.
Chelsea, way to go. Oh, my goodness. Anything you want to share about that?
Yeah. So at one of the rehearsals, the actor who is playing Cleve Jones, we were talking about what is this thing that you're describing here. And I was like, wait, I can find a picture for you, because I was a student at Eastern Michigan University when a panel of the quilt, I think maybe two panels of the quilt, came there. And they were laid out. You can't just lay them on the ground. They were just, you know, sort of propped, but they were like on a platform, right? So you could look down and see them. And I can remember walking through and seeing them there and stopping. And it was such a powerful experience. And I was trying to find a picture to show him. And I think, Dr. John, you must have just overheard our conversation, because I was like, wouldn't that be so cool if we could get this here? Well, you know, maybe you need, I don't know how far in advance you have to ask, but...
And the answer is, you have to ask much more
in advance than
we did, but that's okay. You know, we made some phone calls, some people care, and you make things happen. Yeah.
It's an honor to have it here.
And so I'm very, very grateful that it will be in the Sisson Gallery. Mm-hmm. It will be available for viewing, not just during the Sisson Gallery hours, but also after every performance. Mm. So anyone that comes to see the play, please afterward, walk right down the hall from the Black Box Theater and go and take a moment to really look at it, look at those names, and be with it. It's a lovely, lovely display that Steve Glazer has set up, and it's definitely worth your time.
Yeah, it's truly a multimedia experience. It's incredible. The opportunity to experience the physical panel, which is panel number 2913, as I'm reading in the information here, so they literally have that much, that specific, you know, detail on these, which is brilliant. And to be able to see this performance, I think, is just going to be incredibly emotional. And if you have had someone that you know in your experience of life that has maybe suffered through AIDS or died from AIDS, or someone who is dealing with it now, even more so, right? But I just can't imagine anyone that won't be moved by the way this is going to be respected and honored and showcased by our students. I mean, that's just the coolest thing.
And if I may, speaking of the sort of interdisciplinary nature of this, the multimedia nature of this, and our students, even beyond the actors who are involved with this and the tech people who are involved with this, we also have the HFC chorus who is involved with this. Sort of famously, there is a choir in California, the San Francisco Gay Men's Choir, that today is world-renowned. But historically, they had just formed when Harvey Milk and George Moscone were assassinated, to the point that they were in rehearsals. They had not publicly performed yet. And on the night of the assassination, when there was a large candlelight march in honor of Harvey and George Moscone, they gathered and did their very, very first performance, which was on the steps of City Hall, performing a piece by Mendelssohn called Thou Lord Our Refuge. And I'm very, very thankful to say that our director of our HFC course, Amy Sari, got her students together, and they recorded a gorgeous rendition of Thou Lord Our Refuge, which we played during the show itself. And it's just beautiful. And bringing in that many more students and that local quality of the timelessness of music, tying it all together is just, I'm so proud of what we, sure, have done as a theater program, but so proud of how so much of the college has come together and sort of leaned into this production.
Yeah. It sounds like a million people are going to want to see this and participate in this. But that said, the intimacy of the performance itself is heightened by the intimacy of the theater that it's being housed in. So it's at here at HFC's Black Box Theater. Tell us a little bit about how to get tickets and what your mindset of holding it in that environment involved.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. So when you do Oklahoma, you want to be able to sing loudly over the vast audience and things. That is not quite what we're doing here. It needs to feel intimate. It needs to feel like we're sitting in a living room together having this conversation. And so we have set up the Black Box Theater, which is in room 161 in Building F. So right down the hall from the Sisson Gallery and the Adre Auditorium. We have set it up in a way that we only have 30 seats for audience members per night, and that is not a lot. And so with that in mind, we are strongly recommending people get their tickets ahead of time. We sold out our last show before our opening night. There is a real possibility that that will happen again, so please, I would beg people not to just assume that they can show up on the night and get their tickets then. So with that said, if anyone is interested in getting their tickets soon, you can just go ahead to hfcc.edu/campus-life/theater, or even just Google Henry Ford College Theater and it will pop up. Or if you see one of our posters around, we have a QR code. You can just scan it right there. That'll take you directly to the website to get the tickets. Tickets are just $10. I think the cheapest tickets in town right now for general admission. And then it's even less. It's $5 for any HFC students or employees. We would love to get this thing sold out quickly and see everyone there. Really, I think, important. And I dare say enjoyable piece. I know we're talking about it as if it is this heartbreaking mm-hmm. piece, but it is a piece of love. It is a piece of celebration. Yeah. People should not be shying away because they're saying, I just can't take that weight on my heart right now. Quite the opposite. Come on in and feel that weight lifted a little bit. So I'm hoping to see so many people there.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. In terms of how many opportunities to actually experience this this production, how many performances are you doing?
Yeah, there are six in all. Okay. So there is Friday of this, this coming, that's the 15th, that Friday night. The following day, Saturday the 16th, it'll be a 2 p.m. and a 7:30. Sorry, all the evening ones are at 7:30. The following weekend, again, Friday, Saturday sort of thing. So Friday night, 7:30, Saturdays, 2 p.m. and 7:30, both weeks. Additionally, on that second week, on the 23rd at the 7:30 show, we will be following that up with an after-show talk back with the cast and crew, again, seeing the quilt, although they'll be open every night, as well as some speakers that we'll have there, including Dr. Lonsdale here representing Saga, and we have people in from SAFE at HFC and other organizations to just really talk about the impact, not only of this show, but of reaching out to the community in general and making sure people are aware of options and resources that exist.
Important conversations to have anytime, especially now. Chelsea, when you were asked to be a part of this, did you realize what you were getting into? Did you have an idea of what that was going to look like with your role? And has it so far lived up to what you were expecting?
I don't know that I had any expectations. I think I was just honored that I was asked. I saw the Detroit Wall Project and was so moved that I cried a lot. And I feel like I should be challenging the cast now. Like, how many times can you make me cry in a single show? It will probably be a lot. I love this kind of... I've never experienced this from a theater side, but I have taught documentary poetry. And I think I knew that my role would be tied to stories, to storytelling, and I believe that's important. I believe that stories presented in this way, whether it is through poetry or through acting, stories when presented in that way are really powerful. So I don't know if I had expectations. I will say that it has been an absolute joy to be involved with this. It has been a totally new experience, and I feel so incredibly proud of and inspired by the entire group.
Wonderful. We are wrapping up our discussion today, and we don't want to give too much away about this the entire production, etc. But I love John Michael, how you said that there will be, there is much to celebrate mm-hmm. in the course of this, and it is not just about sad and tears and so on, not unlike the AIDS quilt panel itself, which I'm sure will be incredibly emotional to physically, literally be near to actually see, but thinking about the inspiration that brings to so many people in this world, and again, never going out of style, I think a way to look back and not only honor but remember some of the choices that were some good, some bad, as it related to this or any other tragic experience in our lifetime. The theater productions that you have tended to pick, it's pretty obvious, have meant certainly something deeper than most to you, and ultimately, I'm sure, to the students that have been a part of it. What I find interesting, oftentimes when some of the students are my students, just in related classes and things, and even seeing the students at the end of the run, and they just are so tight and so together and so dialed in on this, just like the Detroit Wall Project most recently. Do you think they realize what they're a part of at this point in time, having not actually done this yet for the audience? I mean, do you think they get the gravity and the importance of what they are representing?
I think I can speak to that a little bit without being a mind reader. Still, I remember... And I'm glad that we're giving such love to the Detroit Wall Project today, because it was a good time. But I remember in doing that one, they seemed to get, oh, this seems pretty cool, until the first time there was an audience there. Mm. And they saw that audience reaction, and they began to see the play through the audience's eyes. And that night, there were a lot of tears, and there was a lot of, wow, this really matters. And I think that we are about to have the same thing with this play as well. I'm already starting to see the flickers of that recognition in some eyes. Sometimes what you do in the world can feel very small, but when you see how someone else reacts to it and you realize, that's when you realize the impact. And I think that that's really the joy of this. And if I could, thank you for mentioning this effort to sort of have themes that I hope breed positivity into the world. I'll take this opportunity to throw a shout out for the fact that our next play will be Gruesome Playground Injuries, coming up in April. And that title sounds like a lot, Gruesome Playground Injuries. And yet, much like this play, so much of it is focused on sometimes life is hard, and sometimes we get injured, and sometimes it can feel like it's always going to be like that. But it is a play entirely about two people helping each other get back up. It's a play entirely about, you fall down on the playground, you get back up and you keep going. And I, if I was to find any theme for this entire season, this play, that play, Happy to Be Dead, which is coming in May, all of them are, you pick yourself up and you keep going.
Advice that will never go out of style, I'm certain. We look forward to that, and we certainly look forward to this. Dear Harvey, the production running Friday, November 15th through Saturday, November 23rd. And again, that complimentary piece, the AIDS quilt, oh my gosh, a panel right here at HFC at the Sisson Gallery that you can experience when you come to see your particular performance date, and it will be on display here at the college through December the 5th. So it is actually being put together literally today, and I don't know if it's going to be officially opened as of tonight. I think it might be tonight, November 8th, but we know it will run through World AIDS Day. As we wrap up today, we thank you both for your time, your passion, your commitment to this wonderful, inspiring storytelling, as well as your commitment to our students here at HFC. It's easy to have that mutual admiration society where we all say to each other, they love you, they love you, but they love you. And I'm talking about both of you. So we thank you for what you do every single day for our students, but in this situation, for our community at large. All the best.
I'm so thankful for this time here with Dr. Lonsdale and with yourself and your listeners. It is always such a joy to be here. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure. We have more on the way. This is the WHFR Journal right here on 89.3 FM. Please do stay with us.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Thank you for staying with us on the WHFR Journal. In our second segment this week, we're going to revisit Sebastian Younger and Tribe. This is a weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts featuring journalist, author, and filmmaker Sebastian Younger as he discusses his book called Tribe, an exploration of how a fractious society disengaged from war may contribute to PTSD suffered by veterans. It is an impactful and important program airing originally in 2017. We say a very special Happy Veterans Day this Monday, November 11th, to our veterans, both present and past. We honor you and we thank you for your service. And thank you for listening to this week's edition of the WHFR Journal. We wish you a very pleasant weekend.
From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Today, in honor of Veterans Day, we're revisiting my 2017 conversation with journalist, author, and filmmaker Sebastian Younger. Sebastian Younger became a well-known author in 1997 with the publication of his first book, The Perfect Storm. Now he's better known as a journalist, deeply engaged in covering war and the people who fight in them. As a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, he's covered international stories, including the war in Afghanistan, a region and subject he's returned to over and over during the course of his career. His book War is based on those dispatches, as is the film Restrepo, which he co-directed with his frequent collaborator, the late photographer Tim Hetherington. Not surprisingly, Sebastian Younger also turned his attention to the complexities soldiers find when they return from war, both with his film The Last Patrol and the book Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. Combining anthropology, psychology, history, and his own observations and experiences in Tribe, Sebastian Younger notes there are primal human needs for loyalty, a sense of belonging, and a connection to something bigger than oneself. And because service members find these connections when they're deployed, returning home can leave some 21st century combat veterans with a profound sense of loss. Add to that loss is the fact that these veterans are returning to a society disengaged from the war in which they've fought. And Younger argues this may account for the high percentage of service members suffering from PTSD. So I sat down with Sebastian Younger to discuss the ideas he offers in Tribe. Here's our conversation. Sebastian Younger, thank you, first of all.
My pleasure.
Tribe is the name of your latest book, and I want to know first what you mean by tribe. How do you refer to it in this book?
There's different meanings for the word tribe, obviously. There's the ethnographic meaning, which is a discrete population, usually in a small-scale society. The way I mean it in this sense really is community. It's a more appealing word for community. But of course, community is one of the essentials, along with food and water and shelter and safety, one of the essentials for survival, for emotional survival. And one of the ironies of wealthy modern society is that as wealth goes up, people have enough money, enough affluence to live more and more individualized lives, which is a great freedom for them, but it also removes their access to community. In fact, individuals don't need the community to survive, and this community doesn't need individuals in order to stay together. And the whole thing is sort of subcontracted to the state and to the corporations. And so there's some advantages to that, but there's a real loss in human terms, in sort of emotional and psychological terms. There's a real loss to that lack of community that we all endure.
Okay, now let's take that loss and bring it to the military, because while I think most of us can at least imagine the trauma of war, the ugliness and the brutality, you make the point in the book that it also can confer something else on people who fight.
Yes, what we know is that the best, most pro-social human behaviors come out in the worst circumstances. So if you ask war reporters, how can you stand to do this job? It's humans at their worst. it's actually humans at their best. I mean, what you see on a front line, you never see racism. You really never see any bias according to politics or sexuality or really anything. I mean, right on the very front line, there's a profound egalitarianism that happens and a commitment to the group good, which is, of course, is deeply embedded in our evolutionary past. And we know that when people live in tight communal situations like that, they experience really improved mental health. So you take modern society, which, of course, we know as wealth goes up in society, the suicide rate goes up, the depression rate goes up, the PTSD rate goes up, anxiety goes up, child abuse goes up, violence against others goes up with wealth. So modern society is actually quite hard to live in psychologically. As soon as you introduce a catastrophe, suddenly people start acting quite well. So the suicide rate went down in New York after 9/11. During the Blitz in London, the government was braced for mass psychiatric casualties during the terrible bombings of London by the German Air Force. In fact, admissions to psych wards went down during the bombing and went back up afterwards. So if you put humans under a certain kind of stress and allow them to bond together, they actually will do better psychologically than during times of stability and peace, ironically.
So let's translate that thinking specifically to the military.
So for soldiers, for the purpose of soldiers, they're in a war zone. If they're on a front line, which is not most soldiers are not in combat, actually, but the 10% or so of our military that is actively in combat, they're subject to trauma and fear and horror and all those other things. But they're also sort of marinated in this close communal connection that is a platoon. A platoon is 30, 40, 50 men, often operating in very close concert with each other and somewhat independently of other groups. That is our evolutionary past. We evolved to live in groups of that size, functioning pretty much like that. So they get to enjoy and appreciate that ancient human system of sort of communality and connection. And then whether they've been traumatized or not, and this is true of soldiers from a rear base as well, when they're taken out of that group, that sort of primordial group of 40, 50 individuals, and brought back to the United States, they experience a really traumatic transition from communalism to individualism. And that is, individualism is not what we evolved for. And it's actually, for all the opportunities it offers, it's extremely hard on us psychologically. And I think a lot of PTSD, what's called PTSD, is often applied to soldiers who never saw combat, who were never traumatized. You know, most of the military was not shot at. But many of them are really suffering during this transition. And I think what they're suffering from is this very difficult transition from a close-knit communal society in their platoon, in their unit, to the sort of isolating, individualized society that we've created in this country.
I think people understand that PTSD is an issue in the United States, but I don't think I certainly didn't get the extent of it, or more importantly, how unusual it is when one looks at other countries.
Yes. I mean, if you talk to the Peshmerga fighters in Iraq and Syria, they have no idea what PTSD is. Like in Israel, there's mandatory military service in Israel, and as a result, the PTSD rate among veterans is 1% in Israel. In our country, it's 20%. And keep in mind, only 10% of the military actually sees any combat. And our PTSD rate is 20%, double what even the combat rate is. That's bizarre. And it's not that American soldiers are less tough than other people or whatever. It's nothing like that. It is, I think, just evidence of the fact that if you're traumatized, we are wired as a species, we're wired to overcome trauma. I mean, if a large percentage of people were psychologically incapacitated by trauma, by a lion attacking the encampment, and effectively became wards of the state afterwards, the human race wouldn't exist, right? Of course, we recover from trauma. We have to. So what's happening in America right now, enormous numbers of veterans are being put on basically lifelong disability because they feel that they were traumatized. But there's something very real going on here. The thing that I think a lot of them are traumatized by is having to give up this close, interconnected, very, very loyal human community that they were in during this incredibly intense part of their lives, having to give that up and, you know, return to the great American suburb.
What got you thinking along these lines to begin with?
I studied anthropology in college. This whole idea started when, you know, I did my field work on the Navajo Reservation. The Navajo, the Comanche, the Apache, the Sioux, and all those native tribes were very, very warlike societies. And I just had this idea at one point, like, I bet those guys weren't getting PTSD back in the 1800s and 1700s. The native fighters in North America, I bet they weren't getting PTSD. I bet they were fine when they came home. There was no transition disorder for a Comanche warrior. They came back from fighting the Texas Rangers and came back to the encampment. Like, of course there wasn't. So what's going on with us? And this is my attempt to explain it.
Well, to add to this, to exacerbate it, such a small percentage of people in the United States are actually in the military, and a very large percentage don't even know anybody who serves.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's not just the military. You know, I own a car. The car runs on gasoline. I don't know anyone who works in an oil field. And the oil field, working in oil fields is more dangerous than most of the MOSs in the U.S. military. Not the frontline combat units, but everybody else. Likewise, logging. I mean, my house is made out of wood. I mean, somebody cut those trees down. Incredibly dangerous business. I had fished the other night. Somebody caught that. Really dangerous business. So, and no, I mean, none of us know any of these people. And so in a small scale communal tribal society, you would know everyone engaged in producing the things that you need in order to survive. You would know those people personally. Even if not personally, you would appreciate their hard work, their dangerous work. In a complex, modern, technology-heavy society, people don't know personally anyone in any of the industries that they survive, that allow them to live. And that, I mean, you know, that's because we're very lucky to live in a kind of society like this. I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but there is a downside. And the military is one of those industries, and it is an industry where very few people know anyone in it, even though they depend on it to protect their country.
Okay, so the large majority of the population is disconnected from the military. What's your solution for that?
The solution is not to greatly expand the military so that 10% of citizens are in the army. I mean, that's not the solution to PTSD. Among other things, the nation couldn't afford it. We don't need a huge military because of the kind of military we have and its training. We can get by with really 0.5% of the population serving in uniform. We can get by with that. Works fine. And we don't have the money for more anyway. But what would help, I think, is mandatory national service. I think it's immoral to force someone to fight a war they don't believe in. But it's entirely moral to ask, in fact, to require people, everyone, to serve their country for some amount of time when they're young. Not only does that, I think, confer enormous psychological benefits to the people that do it. Again, in Israel, the PTSD rate is 1%. There's some indication that's because of national service. But not only that, but it's such a fractured time in America. And what national service would do is take white people and black people and atheists and religious people and rich and poor and everybody else and puts them all in a big pot and stirs them up. And I think that experience when you're young and sort of open to new experiences, new understandings of the world, might go a long way towards sort of bringing this country back together a little bit.
You know what it's like to return from a war zone because you've done it so many times. What do you find within yourself? What did you find when you returned?
Well, there's two issues. I've returned from war zones. I've worked all over the world. You know, if you were traumatized over there, coming back was, you know, it was always a little complicated. You know, it's a little jarring, just among other things, to be in a very poor country and then just to see the just sort of grotesque abundance of variety and wealth that's on display in this country. I mean, I just remember the, after I came back from Afghanistan in 2000, and, you know, I lost 20 pounds over there. I landed in L.A. and stayed at a hotel and came down for breakfast in the morning, and there was a breakfast buffet. And I was looking at an amount of food that, I mean, I hadn't seen that much food in 2 months, and it was a kind of paradise, except it was really kind of revolting. I mean, it was just this opulent spread, and it really kind of revolted me about something about our society. It really turned me off. So that is jarring. That is hard to come back to, ironically. But in addition, American soldiers have to give up this tight communal connection of a platoon and come back this sort of alienating experience. So when I was doing my work overseas with American soldiers, I also affiliated with this group and also had a very hard time giving it up. And I was enormously depressed afterwards, partly because I had grown to psychologically need that group. I didn't know it was happening. I didn't think that was going to happen. But that's my only explanation for the really difficult emotions that I had over there when I came back. And, you know, I wasn't particularly traumatized when I was with those guys. We were in some firefights, but that wasn't the problem. It was giving up that group. And really, I was quite a mess when I came back.
Did you know what was going on with you? Did you think, oh, I have PTSD?
I mean, I had no idea. This is before PTSD was talked about. Came back from one assignment and I kept having panic attacks in the subway. And, you know, there was no subway in Afghanistan. I didn't had no way to connect it to what had happened in Afghanistan when I was there. And eventually I sort of figured it out. But I got over it. People do. Most people do recover from PTSD, recover from everything, actually. And I did as well. But what was particularly hard, again, wasn't recovering from trauma. I think we're wired to do that. I don't think we're wired to normalize giving up the community that you're in that you value. There's no evolutionary wiring that allows you to like gracefully transition from being a valued part of a close group to just being on your own. That is not something we've evolved for, and it clearly is very hard for us and dangerous to do. People are prone to depression, to suicide. They're prone to high rates of PTSD. People do not do well on their own, and that's what the society has created, is 350 million people that are basically individuals that are not affiliated with close communities.
I don't know how much you know about Creative Forces, the initiative that is led by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs. And it offers creative arts therapies to military patients. And it's found that, in fact, the arts really have been very helpful in easing those traumas.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, the National Endowment for the Arts has been so committed to working with service members and has done such an incredible job with them. I mean, I think creative expression is enormously beneficial. I think it's empowering. I think the process of writing, of making music, of making art, theater, is enormously empowering. So instead of feeling like you're subjected to emotions that you can't control, that you don't understand, I think what happens with artistic expression is that you're using those emotions, and now the tables have turned, and actually, instead of being subjected to them, you are employing those feelings. You're creating something constructive with them. And I think that for someone who's suffering from grief, from the loss of a partner, or loss of a brother or sister in combat, or depression, or PTSD, or what have you, I think it's enormously beneficial to have that kind of outlet.
Well, you know, military patients, veterans who suffer from PTSD or traumatic brain injury, I mean, obviously, their families suffer as well. And often it's through art, in fact, that service members can tell their stories and communicate with their families.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, using art, using music, using any creative force like that to express one's emotional experience, spiritual experience, can be life-saving. I mean, I think it's absolutely essential. And it's, and frankly, it's one way for people to make a statement to protect something that's sacred. And the community is sacred. The nation is sacred. And it really will be up to all of us. And it's particularly up to veterans to protect that sacred thing.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the issues you detail in your book. And one other thing, a newer component to Creative Forces is bringing local artists in to work in conjunction with art therapists, with service members, with their families, in part to really create an expressive local community for service members. It really does help create community.
Absolutely. I mean, that relationship between teacher and student, or someone who knows something and someone who's learning something, or whatever you want to describe it, is an incredibly important relationship. And also the act of expressing your experience to a group that wants to understand what you went through and values your existence, that is ancient. It's extremely valuable. And so one of the things I did in researching my book, Tribe, was to look at some of the processes, some of the ritual processes, some of the ceremonies that Native American tribes in this country, in the United States, would do to reincorporate returning warriors back into the community. And these ceremonies are still done. And really interesting, Native Americans comprise the largest percentage of the U.S. military by population. In other words, there are a higher percentage of Native Americans are in the armed forces than of any other population group, any other demographic in this country. And they have some of the lowest rates of PTSD. So what would happen is that people would come back, and I talked to some guys that were in the 173rd Airborne that I was over there with who were Native American and from Oklahoma and Texas, and they came back and went through this process, where basically the community gathered and they had a dance, a ritual, and the veterans would dance and sing and tell the story of their deployment. And that's absolutely ancient. This is something that has been going on for centuries. And the context has changed. It's not the old days with the buffalo and the teepees and whatever. But it doesn't matter. The point is that you get to tell your community what you did for them. And they get to participate in the moral burden and the celebration. The moral burden of conducting war and killing other people and the celebration of your bravery and your accomplishments and the grief at losing people. The community gets to participate in all of that and share it. And that's very healthy for both sides of the equation.
And it's up to us to listen to veterans. Yeah. In tribes, you mentioned that the Papago Indian tribe thought war was nuts.
Insane.
But when it came time and they had to fight, the people who fought, they gained a kind of wisdom through that experience. Do you think this is true for the people fighting today?
Yes. I mean, I think anyone who confronts death gains wisdom. And I think that's also true of people who have been very ill. If they survive, they come back from their disease with a wisdom that, you know, other people don't have and won't have till much later in their lives. And likewise for soldiers, some soldiers, not all soldiers. I mean, some people are just doing a job in a rear base and they're really not engaged in war except in a very conceptual sense. But people that are really seeing death, risking death, yes, they do have a special wisdom. And it is a kind of sacred knowledge. And traditional tribal societies understand that and use it. They protect it and they use it and they honor it.
Tribe connotates a manageable size, I mean, almost by definition. Yeah. And we live in a very large country, I mean, sitting in a very large city, which I do feel is my tribe. How do we take this very large, modern society we live in and begin to think of ourselves as part of a tribe?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we've never tried this before. I mean, for most of human history, we lived in small groups of people that we knew, you know, quite well personally. And in those small communities were part of larger affiliations of people that we knew moderately well or had on good authority that they were in the same tribe we were, even if we didn't know them personally. I mean, that's human society for hundreds of thousands of years. Now, we live in a nation of 300 plus million. What the nation proposes to you is, look, the vast majority of people in your nation, you're not going to know personally. But trust us, you have something in common and you all have a vested interest in operating with similar goals and in a unified way. Just trust us. If you do this with the other 300 plus million, we'll all be better off. Acting in unison with other people when you know them, that makes intuitive sense. But to do that with a nation of 300 some million, that's a stretch. And so the question is, can we take those really powerful human instincts to affiliate and to belong and to be loyal to a group? Can we take those and enact them over on the scale of 300 million? Can we do that? And I think we can, but it doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen automatically. You have to be proactive in setting that out as a goal. So you have to say, how are we going to do this? Or what can we do that bonds everybody? Simply paying your taxes doesn't have enough emotional resonance to make us all feel like we're one people. But what about national service? That would start to do it. Psychologists will tell you that the more someone sacrifices for something, the more they value it. And one of the real tragedies of modern society is that we don't ask for any sacrifice whatsoever from our citizens. Zero, nothing, zip. And if you don't want to pay your taxes, you can almost figure out a way to do that. We need to change that. And I think we can.
Let me ask you this. In the book, you bring up people finding this sense of solidarity and community and meaning when they're in really dire situations. Do you think it's possible in this modern world to find that sense of community and purpose through joy rather than war and suffering?
Well, you know, I think the way it works, I mean, we're the products of evolution. And when society is under threat, people give up their individual interests in exchange for a kind of group solidarity because we survive best in groups, right? When the chips are down, people affiliate. they act in ways that look really very noble and generous and brave, because frankly, that's where their survival lies, is in everyone doing that. When things are going great and the enemy has not like arrayed themselves on the far ridgeline and ready to swoop into camp with their swords unsheathed, what evolution has wired us for is to, at that point, when you don't need the community as much to survive, work on the individual. And when you have people working on their own thing, that's when you invent the bow and arrow. That's when you invent calculus. That's when you invent the iPhone. I mean, that's when those great inventions come about, is people attending to their own intellects because they don't need to put their resources in the community. So my point is that all of our behavior is a function of evolution. So can we somehow hack evolution? Can we sort of cheat it and have the solidarity that we get during a crisis along with the ingenuity that we enjoy when there's no crisis and not have the crisis? We might. We're a clever species, but we have to work at it. And that means, in my opinion, that means something like national service. And we're not going to get all the way there. We're not going to be as unified as we were after 9/11 on the streets of New York. It's just not going to happen. But we might get halfway there. And that halfway might be good enough.
Catastrophe aside, we're not returning to hunter-gatherer days in the near future. So given where we are, what do we need to give our service members so they can successfully, happily reintegrate?
I think everyone needs to change their attitude. I think civilians have to stop thinking that the war belongs to the soldiers. We paid for it. We okayed it. It's our war. And we have to stop imagining that it's somehow not. And if it's our war, these are the people that did our bidding. Even if we voted against it, they still did our national bidding when they come back. I think it's really important for the community to hear the stories of soldiers and the soldiers to have the opportunity to tell their community. And we all of us are from a town or a city. All of us are from some sort of community. And soldiers fought for the nation, but really, in emotional terms, they fought for their community, whatever that is. And so I started this initiative called Veteran Town Hall. And what we do is we take over a town hall on Veterans Day when it's not being used anyway. And you can go watch the parade or whatever. I don't think there's a lot of therapeutic value in a parade, frankly. It's a nice gesture, but I don't think it does anyone a lot of good. But what does seem to do people good is talking. So we take over a town hall, and veterans of any war who fought in any capacity, you could be a supply clerk, I don't care, or frontline combat vet, man, woman, it doesn't matter. The veterans of any war, I have the right to stand up for 10 minutes and say anything they want about their experience, as long as it's honest. And if you're enraged at your government that you had to fight Vietnam, let it out. If you're super proud of your service in Iraq or Afghanistan, tell us. If you're just still in deep grief about someone you lost, you can just stand up there and cry if you want. I mean, all of those reactions are human reactions to war. And what happens is, so the community comes in to hear these people. And there are some anti-war people in the community or pro-war. It doesn't matter. You're part of the community. These people fought for you, even if it was a war you didn't agree with. It doesn't matter. They did it. And so the veterans say what they have to say. And the civilian population hears and has to join in the moral burden and the celebration and the grief of what we've all done.
Sebastian, thank you.
My pleasure.
I really, really enjoy talking to you.
It's a real pleasure speaking with you and really doing anything that I can to support what you're doing. I think it's incredibly important to the nation.
That was my 2017 conversation with author and filmmaker Sebastian Younger. We were discussing his book Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. You can find out more about it at sebastianyounger.com. And you can find out more about Creative Forces at arts.gov. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating on Apple. It will help people to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.